Welcome to the second Hands on Physics podcast. Sorry it's taken so long to get out, but unfortunately life gets in the way sometimes. So today we're going to be getting down with gravity. So we're going to start with some basics on universal gravitation and move into projectile motion. So we'll start with a really simple idea. Talk gravity, talk Newton. Generally, you think about the apple falling on the head. Probably didn't really happen. Just more of an anecdote to try and explain how gravity works. So we're going to talk about basically bodies falling just due to gravity. We're going to ignore air resistance for most of what we're talking about. And we're going to focus pretty much entirely on gravity being the only force on objects in the air. Newton was a little bit of a borrower like Einstein. Einstein was great at putting together people's ideas into a valid formula. Newton, pretty much most of his ideas come directly from Galileo. You might have heard of the famous Galileo experiment where he dropped a bowling ball, or a cannonball as it was back then, and a tiny little musket ball, which is kind of like a ball bearing, under the premise they would both hit the ground at the same time, which they did. From the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which probably once again didn't happen, more of a thought experiment than an actual occurrence. So what we're going to do is we're really going to look at how this works from a qualitative perspective, and I'm not really going to focus too much on the calculations because it's a little bit hard to do in this scenario. So main things you need to remember is that if we release an object near the Earth's surface, we can assume that its acceleration is pretty much going to be 9.8 meters per second squared, or for simplicity terms, we might just use 10 meters per second squared. 10's fine for the exams. Examiners don't have a problem with that and generally makes calculations a hell of a lot easier. So we'll start with projectile motion. So if I fire an object, or push it, or strike it, or throw it, or anything which results in an object entering the air, it's going to act like a projectile. And once it acts like a projectile, that object is going to form a lovely curved parabolic path. And the only thing that's actually going to act on it is gravity. So if you think about, if I was to draw back an arrow on a bow, and then I was to release that arrow and let it fly through the air, and then strike its target, in order to hit a target that was further away, I wouldn't be able to aim straight at the target, I would have to aim up slightly. The further I was away, the further I would have to aim up. This is a really easy scene if you, for example, have played the Wii Sports Resort game where they've got the archery, or any of those sorts of, anything with a shooting type of perspective from a distance, you're going to have to account for that extra distance by firing into that arc shape. When we follow this arc shape, the only thing that's going to actually act on our object is gravity pulling it straight down. So one of the questions they love to ask in exams is they'll have an object which is in a projectile type motion, and they will simply just be asking you, what are the forces acting on the object at point X and Y or wherever it may be? Regardless of what's occurring, the only thing acting at any of those points can be gravity unless they ask you about air resistance. Like I said before, air resistance, all you need to remember about that is it's going to act opposite direction of motion and it's going to be a small component of the force acting. The majority of it's going to be gravity, but some of it's going to be acting. It's always going to be acting opposite to the way you're traveling. So in most questions where we're ignoring air resistance, the only force acting is gravity and it's pulling it downwards. This has an interesting effect on all of our projectile motion questions. Basically, this means that I can talk about the horizontal section as if it is straightforward speed, distance, time graph. Okay? Traveling in that distance, its speed never changes. So its horizontal velocity never changes whatsoever. The only thing acting gravity only acts in the vertical direction. So because of this, any object which is traveling through the air, I know that its horizontal velocity will stay constant in our lovely physics world, which is completely absence of air. So if you really want to think about it as if we're doing all these experiments on the moon. Which kind of makes you think, if I took a bowling ball and a feather and I actually dropped them on the moon, believe it or not, they'd actually hit the ground at the same time because they both have the same acceleration. They both would cover that distance in the same amount of time, but air resistance plays a bigger part on the feather than the bowling ball, obviously, on our particular environment. So when we're talking about a projectile motion, we're going to split our questions into two parts. I recommend that you try to keep the questions separated into what is happening horizontally and what is happening vertically, and the only thing that correlates between the two is the time of flight. So time is the only thing that is consistent between the two. So any particular point during the flight, the time of both the horizontal and the vertical components will be the same. The distance will vary. The distance in the horizontal will be a horizontal distance. Distance in the vertical will be a displacement up and down. The velocity is going to be different because the horizontal velocity is going to be the velocity in the horizontal direction, and the vertical is going to be the vertical velocity. And obviously we've also got our acceleration acting in our vertical, but there's no acceleration in our horizontal. So by keeping these two apart, it's a lot easier to work your way through your questions. There's also something called the range formula out there, which is fantastic for working out the distance an object travels as long as the object is fired from and lands at the same elevation. If there's any change in elevation at all, you can't actually use the range formula. The reason the range formula is really, really good is because when you fire an object from one point over and to the same height, it actually has a displacement of zero. And when you put a displacement of zeros into some questions, it can make things a little bit confusing. So find that, look it up, find exactly what it is, learn how to use it, but be aware that you really need to be careful on where and when you use it. If you don't use it properly, then you will not get marks for just writing that formula down. You need to be able to use it properly to actually get the results you're after. Another way of thinking about projectile motion is if you were, for example, playing golf, and you were to strike the ball, if you hit it flat, for example, with a putter, it's not going to go very far. So you'll notice that most of the golf clubs have a slant on them, and that variety of the slant will determine both how high and how far the ball goes. So for example, if I want to chip it, which means I want to get it quite high but not very far, it'll have quite an extreme angle. If I wanted to get it a decent distance, I'll use, for example, I'll use an iron, which might have a different degree of angle depending on how far I want to hit it. The flatter the angle is, the further distance will go, but I still have to have a little bit of angle to get it up in the air. That's another reason why we put our golf balls on a tee, to give that little bit of elevation to start with. All right, so basically with projectile motion, it's only gravity that's acting, and that kind of leads us next into our satellite work. So when we have an object, let's say, for example, we take our golf ball and we hit our golf ball and we hit it really hard. It's going to travel in a lovely, nice arc until we get to a certain point. If I was to hit that golf ball even harder, then it would travel further. It would almost get to the point where I could, if I was able to hit my golf ball hard enough, once again, remembering, we're not talking about air resistance can be ignored. If I was able to hit my golf ball hard enough around the Earth, eventually it will get to a point where it's falling towards the Earth, but it never actually reaches it because of the changing shape of the Earth. So it would be consistently falling towards the Earth, but it would actually end up traveling straight around the Earth. And this is where we get our satellites. Our satellites are basically traveling all the way around our Earth and consistently falling towards it, but they never quite get there. So if I, for example, take an apple as a different example, and let's say I'm standing on a small asteroid, then I would probably be able to actually throw my apple hard enough that it would travel around my asteroid, provided, of course, my asteroid is a lovely circle shape, which in our lovely physics world always is the case. Apple would travel around our asteroid and could actually come back and hit me in the head. Now this actually, for those of you sci-fi fans out there, there's a show called Red Dwarf, and on that show, two of the guys were actually playing golf on the moon, and one of them's teed off, hit the ball, wandered off to find his ball, ball's gone right around the asteroid and landed right back at the feet of the other person. Now I know that seems a bit silly, but it's actually quite possible. The harder you throw the object, the more chance you have of that object escaping the Earth's gravity. So basically put, if I throw it just the right speed, it will orbit around the Earth perfectly and will stay there provided nothing else exits. If I throw it a little bit slower though, it will orbit around the Earth, but it will slowly spiral in until it hits the surface. If I throw it a little bit faster, though, it will slowly spiral outwards and will actually will escape the Earth's gravity. This is actually what's happening to the moon at the moment. The moon, as it travels in orbit around our planet, is actually moving around, escaping about 4 centimeters a year. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's happening every single year. So every time the moon goes around, it spirals a little bit further out from where we currently are. And as it goes a little bit further out, it goes even further. And so it's a slow process. So eventually, I'm not talking in your lifetime, I'm not talking in the lifetime probably of your generations to come, but eventually the Earth will lose its moon. So there's an example of what happens when you're not traveling basically at the right speed. If the moon was traveling a tiny little bit faster, then it would stay in that constant orbit around the Earth. If it was traveling a little bit slower, it would stay in that position. If it was traveling even slower than that, it would actually start to spiral in towards the Earth until it collided. Not a happy thought. So the last thing we really want to do is try and slow the moon down to try and make sure we don't lose it, and then in effect turn around and make our moon the biggest asteroid this planet has ever seen. Alright, so when we talk about satellite motion, we are talking about projectile motion, but we are just talking about it in a different context. So as a satellite goes around, we're going back to what we were doing with circular motion. So the object follows circular motion. The only difference being is that centripetal acceleration, that centripetal force supplied to the satellite, is only due to gravity. So it's kind of like our vertical circular motion we were doing earlier on the year, but it acts the whole way around, and it keeps that satellite perfectly around our world. And basically, that is the only force acting on that object. This causes some really weird and wonderful stuff to happen. If you're up in a space station, and in the future, who knows, you might get to visit one, and you're traveling around and zooming around the Earth at about 8,000 meters a second, and you all should know how fast that is, you would actually, not only would you feel nothing, but you'd be kind of superhuman in that you would actually be able to float through your space station. If you go on YouTube and you look up any little videos of astronauts in space, you can actually see that they can actually float around in there. Now, they're not actually weightless. All that's actually happening is they're actually falling at the same rate as the rest of the space station. So they're in a perpetual free fall. It's like being in an elevator shaft and the elevator just drops and hurtles towards the ground. You wouldn't get slammed up to the roof, as sometimes is shown in, for example, cartoons, that sort of stuff. You would actually sort of hover there in midair. Not necessarily midair, but since you were initially standing on the ground, you'd probably stay on the ground, but you wouldn't feel the ground under your feet. Those of you who went to the VCE Physics Day, it would be just like the shock drop, when as soon as it released underneath you, you stay in your seat, but you don't feel the seat underneath you. If you jump, obviously you would move up into the air and you would stay in the air until that unfortunate moment when you stop falling and you crash. It's one of those common things they say. It's not the fall that kills you, it's the sudden stop at the end. So most skydivers, injuries occur when they land because the amount of force required to stop them, if they don't do it properly, broken legs, all that sort of stuff. But you can't actually die from a fall, you can only die from that sudden stop at the end of it. All right, so going back to our satellites. So for example, you are doing some work up in a satellite. And you're going around, so for example, you're across the International Space Station, you're doing some gravity work up there, doing some biological work. Let's say, for example, you've become a specialist biologist and you're doing some zero-gravity biology work. What you'd actually find is that the ability to lift things, everything would kind of feel like it doesn't have much weight. So, for example, you'd be able to pick up anything, any objects pretty much, and they would feel kind of like they have no weight. Not as in they would have no weight, you'd still have to move them, okay? But your body would require much less muscle mass to move around. this is kind of seen well. If you've ever seen footage of Apollo 11 when they're on the moon, okay, that's an example of lower gravity. So you can imagine what it'll be like in zero gravity. Sorry, apparent weightlessness. I shouldn't use the word zero gravity because that can be quite confusing. Apparent weightlessness is when you are falling with an object. So you have apparently weighed nothing, but you still have a weight force acting on you. So we're up in our space station, we're moving things around, we want to go from one side of the room to the other. All we do is we put our feet on the wall, push off, and we will basically fly across the room. Pretty cool, I reckon. But obviously, this also comes with some other problems. If you're up in this environment for a large amount of time, your body would require much less muscle mass to move around. Because the whole day, even when you're at school, you're sitting down to do work, you go out and play sport, you walk around normally, your body's muscles are supporting yourself. Same with your bones. Your bones and your muscles are what keeps you up and keeps you moving. If we take away the requirement of them to fight gravity, which in essence we deal with this, then when we are doing things, our muscle mass decreases. Our bone density can decrease. So gravity can actually have some other effects that we don't even think about. All right, so going back one little thing to the moon moving away. That's a little while ago. This is not something that, you know, we've calculated using all sorts of instruments, that sort of stuff. When Apollo 11 actually landed on the moon, they actually installed some little reflectors to allow us to actually measure the distance to the moon, and basically a laser gets sent out and they time how long it takes for it to go out and come back, because we know what the speed of light is, so that's all fixed. And from that, they've determined that it's actually moving away at that set speed. Okay, so with our satellites, just really be aware that if you've got any questions more from the qualitative perspective to asking you, let's say, for example, we've got a spring balance holding a weight and you're holding onto that spring balance in a satellite, the spring balance would actually register zero. The reason being is that you, the spring balance, the satellite, everything would actually be falling all together. So there's no resistive force. So when you measure something with a spring balance standing on the Earth, you're the resistive force. You're stopping that weight from falling down. But when you're in a satellite, nothing's stopping that weight from falling down because you're all falling together. So that really brings me back to our weight. So I talked a little bit previously about apparent weight. So apparent weight is not actually your weight force, but is more the restorative force that is applied to your body to oppose that force. So for example, the reason that I feel like I weigh a certain amount has actually nothing to do with gravity, but has everything to do with the fact that the Earth's surface pushes back on me and stops that gravity from pulling me to the center of the Earth. So I feel how much I weigh by the contact I have with objects. So when I sit on a chair, I feel how much I weigh based on the feeling that I get through my body, which is due to the chair pushing back up on me, so basically I don't fall and hit the floor. Same thing with my feet when I'm walking around. The apparent weight is actually that resistive force I'm experiencing. So when we're back up in these satellites, that resistive force isn't required. There is no balancing out because we are consistently falling. What is the net force and where does it act? So what is the name of the net force and where does it act? Okay, pause me now. And thinking time over. And hopefully you got the answer that the net force is gravity and it always acts towards the center of the Earth, or towards the surface of the Earth is fine as well. Okay, question two, multiple choice. If the moon was traveling faster, it would be A, stable in its motion, so it would have a perfectly lovely circular motion and it would stay at a set radius around the Earth. B, spiral faster out of the Earth's gravity. C, spiral slower out of the Earth's gravity. Or D, spiral inwards towards the Earth. Okay, thinking time. And back again, and the answer to that one is it would spiral faster out of the Earth's gravity. So that's answer B. And finally, last question. Apparent weight is not the weight that you guess someone is, but is rather what. So what is apparent weight? Thinking time again. Okay, apparent weight is the name given to the feeling of having weight. So it's not the weight force itself, but apparent weight is due to that restorative force which enables you to think that you have weight. So, for example, a chair pushing back up on you, or the ground pushing up on you. All right, so hopefully the next one, which is on energy transfers and collisions, should be done by the next week. Please let me drop any comments. I need as much feedback as possible to know whether this is worthwhile and anything I can do to improve, because this is completely new to me. Last little thing I want you to think about was, there are many laws of gravitation. Aristotle's first law of gravitation was that objects fall to the ground because they're made up of more or less earth element. So, for example, rocks fall to the ground because they're made up of a lot of earth element, and feathers don't because they're made up of a lot of air. Didn't really fly that well. Then Newton came along and basically said that objects fall to the ground because of a gravitational attraction towards the earth. Einstein came along later and said, no, it's actually not that. Gravitation is actually due to the curvature of space-time, which is largely above what we need to do. That leaves the last one, which you probably haven't heard of, which is Darwin's theory of gravitation, which was that initially trees dropped apples in all directions, but luckily for the ones that fell to the ground, they seeded and grew more trees, and then they dropped more apples, and the ones that fell to the ground seeded and grew more trees. And thus, through the process of natural selection, we ended up with apples that all happened to fall towards the ground. So that's a bit of a different take on gravitation. I hope that this has been helpful in some ways. Once again, give me any feedback you possibly can. I'll also attach my email address so you can drop me a line to give me some things you request. The email is hans, H-A-N-N-S, dot Nathan, .j@edumail.vic.gov.au. Looking forward to hear your comments and any requests. Thank you very much for your time, and I'll see you hopefully in about a week.